So when you gave your statement to the police, it went further, did it? And it escalated, and then eventually he gets arrested in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, it took quite a long time, mainly the tyranny of distance, unfortunately. So I had to come into the station again. I had to give a proper official statement regarding my allegations to a specialist WPC. That was taken on. Then I was called into a specialist unit where they do video recording evidence. So I more or less just sat and told the details of what had occurred to me while they had hidden cameras recording it all. And I think they had to change the DVD because it took so long. And then they had to transcribe that into the written form, and then it had to go to Exeter, and then it had to go to Interpol, and then it eventually, sort of 6 months later, ended up in South Australia, where a detective was allocated the case, and my father was arrested in June of 2013.
Right, and your father, who was, I think, early 70s at this stage,
I think he was 73.
His name, remind me his name, Roger Smales, isn't
it? That's right, Dr. And Roger Joseph.
Exactly,
Smales.
Well, I looked him up on the internet, and there's loads and loads of stuff about what a brilliant dentist he was and all that stuff. You know, completely the other side of the story that you're telling. And I guess he was, what, there was a knock on the door, and he's arrested, and the whole thing begins to collapse.
Yeah, it's a bit like that, although being a typical non-remorseful sort of sociopath that he was, his immediate response from what the detective told me was that he was angry. You know, he was really annoyed that somebody would dare to kind of arrest him and make any of these allegations or charges. He breached his bail twice, and it was only because of his age and his sort of social standing, I suppose, that he wasn't remanded in custody, because he flouted the courts blatantly by breaching his bail conditions.
And did you then get a trial date?
It was meant to be January the 13th, so a couple of weeks from now.
And when did you then get news that he'd taken his life?
I had a phone call on November 9th, so it was Remembrance Sunday. I had a phone call from my mother, who never rings me. So I immediately thought the worst. I think the first time she rang me in one of those kind of calls was to say that my brother had had an accident and he's been a paraplegic for the last 30 years. And as my son had a brain hemorrhage in April, I thought it was a call about him to say that something awful had happened to him. And she just said, I don't really know how to say this, but your dad committed suicide an hour ago. And right. That was that.
And what were your feelings when you heard that news? Because you'd gone through this process and got him to the steps of the court.
Well, you know, the process itself is just horrendous. You know, I wouldn't wish anyone going through that. You know, it was a year and a half or more of pure, unadulterated hell, as there was delay after delay, adjournment after adjournment. You're having to relive it all time and time again. You have no voice. You're powerless all over again. It's just like being re-victimized. So when I heard that call, obviously I was, you know, trying to process it, and it was shock, and I was like numb to begin with. I mean, there was no sort of huge feelings, and then I was angry, you know. I was pissed. I was thinking, oh my god, you put me through all this, and now I'm not actually going to have the opportunity to make him face up to his actions and pay the price. You know, I thought he deserved to be sent down.
And as I mentioned, you put his name in a search engine, and it still says this highly decorated dental specialist instead of what it should say.
Yeah, well, if you dig deep enough, you will find there's a newspaper article in the local paper, because After I received that news, obviously, you know, it's a Sunday, I'm halfway around the world. I had to email the detective because I didn't know whether they would be aware of the, you know, the sudden turn in of events. And I just thought, he needs to be named and shamed. I don't want him to be buried with somebody saying this amazing eulogy about this wonderful man without him being exposed for sort of the horrible person that he was. Because, you know, it wasn't just me. There were other victims. There were three other victims as part of this case that came forward as a result of my, you know, starting the initial proceedings. And so as soon as I got the all clear from the police that legally I was allowed to, you know, use his name and say it, I was on the phone speaking to a reporter at 3 a.m. in the morning, just desperately trying to get something in the paper before there was a funeral.
And I think I saw your story online as a result of that, and was just shocked by the whole thing, particularly by the fact that you said that you, for years you wanted him dead, and then finally, when you made all, you went through all of this to go the other way, he then just eludes justice at the very end.
Yeah, and you know, on the back of the conversation I had with this reporter, he obviously, you know, wrote his story in the way that he thought, and there was nothing that I hadn't said or that wasn't correct, but it didn't really provide the full picture of how awful prosecuting someone for childhood sexual abuse is. So I then went ahead and wrote my own story, which I then was published in my local paper here in Penzance, and then I approached The Guardian, and that's where it went kind of global. And I don't know whether you saw the comments that were under The Guardian piece.
No,
but
I've got it here, but I haven't got the comments well enough.
Unbelievable. It was over 500 people kind of responded to that, and I suppose that was the reason why I wrote it, and why the reason I'm sat here very nervously talking to you today, full of phlegm. So it's because I wanted to raise awareness about the issue. It's not necessarily my story. You know, childhood sexual abuse is endemic in well, globally, and the, you know, the figures are just so sobering. You know, I think it's 1 in 20 or something that has been reported. 1 in 20 children in the UK. That's 5%. 5% of kids. And, you know, 90% of those kids, it's by someone they know. It's none of this stranger danger kind of myth that's perpetrated. It's, you know, usually members of their family or, you know, close friends. You know, it's the impact that is made upon kids. You know, we all just end up having these really difficult lives as a result of it. You don't go through that experience and come out unscarred. You only have to sort of dig around in the sort of prison populations and people who, you know, suffer from drug and alcohol issues or, you know, mental health. You know, the proportions of people who, you know, have difficult lives are staggering if you know, uncover how many have been abused as children.
Thank you very much, Dee, for speaking to us, Fee.
Thank you, Jeremy. Sorry if I rambled.
You didn't at all. Thank you for telling us the story.
Well, thank you. And I hope, you know, my one hope is that if anyone hears this and they feel touched by it and, you know, that experience is theirs as well, you know, it's not for everyone to come forward, it isn't, but it's always helpful to seek support, to seek advice, you know, and not to feel ashamed or, you know, this. I just want people to sort of be able to talk about this openly and not brush it under the carpet any longer.
Thank you very much. Have a great 2015 and all the best to you.
And yourself. Thank you.